Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kendrick, and joining me this week, we've got Shane Lees.
Hello.
And from the V2 Academy, we've got Peter Prickett.
Hi, everyone.
You guys both well?
No.
What's wrong, Shane?
Well, we have Mark Hughes as manager now.
All right, we'll go straight in with that then. I know you weren't on the show last week, so we discussed it, but what were your thoughts? Other than negative, I suppose.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I didn't actually listen to last week's V2 show. But I don't understand why we got him. This is for Corby. None of it makes any real sense the more you think about it. Because we've got Mark Hughes in, who's a manager who was already getting the club relegated. We've got him in to save a club from relegation. But we've brought him in only for the last seven games. That's as long as his contract lasts. If we go down, he gets sacked. Or just, you know, his contract is over. If we stay up, he probably doesn't keep his job anyway because he's not the kind of manager we want. And I think, if we're doing that, why are we paying for someone like Hughes? Because even that kind of short-leg contract will still cost us potentially millions. Why didn't we just, if we're going to do that, go, right, okay, this really isn't him. We realise kind of how much of a bad position we are. Let's give it to Kelvin Davis in the back room. Mm. Let's give it to one of our coaches. Or, if we're turning around and doing everything and saying, right, no, we actually want to bring in a manager, stay up or go down, he's the one who's going to be sticking around. Why on earth would we get Mark Hughes?
So
if we're thinking long-term, it doesn't make sense. If we're thinking short-term, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, I would say that firstly, it's different points what you raised, but I think Pellegrino's had a chance, and I think at this point it's fair enough to sack him. That's a different argument,
yeah,
though.
Absolutely. But completely. He had to go earlier.
Regards to Mark Hughes, I think if you've got a seven-game contract, I would argue that makes sense because if he does, assuming if the clubs stay up, he gets offered a contract. If he's relegated, he gets sacked. That's reasonable. If he keeps the club up, personally, I think he should get a new contract, and I think. You can also point to the fact you look at some of the other names, Roy Hodgson, David Moyes, who are sort of seen as old, past it figures who've done decent jobs. Do you not think there's a legitimate argument? Or that was the argument made last week.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's a case of he's too old or anything like that. I actually think Mark Hughes is a good manager. He did a good job with City over the years. He did a very good job with QPR that went kind of under the radar because of the amount of money QPR spent. But I just look at it and think he's not exactly a manager. Got a reputation for turning teams around. He's not really, the last couple of seasons, he's kind of completely lost, you know, his head of steam.
Okay.
I can't understand why we decided he's then the manager to pull us out of the
school. Okay.
That's the bit that doesn't make sense to me. If we're doing that, I think you go for someone who is a proper get you out of a scrap man. And I admit it's difficult to think of one, but for maybe someone like Neil Warnock, even though he's already said he wouldn't manage in the Premier League, I still ran that job, he might have gone for it. But if we're going to do that, go for something proper like that, or go for something interim, knowing it's kind of an inevitability, or one way or the other, or you know you're likely to go down, if you stay up fine, that's pretty happy anyway. Or go for something that's going to be a bit more long-term. We didn't really seem to do anything of any world. What I feel like we've done is the board have tried to justify their own. They've said to themselves, we need to be seen to make an effort. We need to be seen to be trying. Let's do this. This looks like we're trying to do. If they get in a, someone from the back room to be an interim, it doesn't look like they've really made a decision.
Mm.
So I think that's why they've not gone. I think they know their position among the fans is quite weak at the moment. The likes of Kruger, who's our chairman, Les Reed, who's our equivalent of director of football. I think they've realised that most fans are kind of losing faith in what they're doing and don't really understand particularly what they're doing. So I think they've thought they have to make a decision. But I'll put it anyway as well, what you said before. I think if Mark Hughes keeps us up, I still don't think it's his job. Oh. Southampton, we have a club who sacked Nigel Adkins after he went 16 games unbeaten.
All right.
We make pretty cynical decisions.
Okay, fair enough. Peter, what are your thoughts on the Mark Hughes?
Who's available? I don't think there's many people available for the job. The real dig you out of a hole type of manager, they're all employed. So who'd you get? And that's who you're going to attract as well. So in terms of what was out there, I don't really think you could have found much better than Mark Hughes.
I think it's completely true. There wasn't a lot better for what we could go out and get immediately. But I do think, we went for a manager who was going down anyway in Pellegrino. And we went for another manager who was going down anyway before, when we had a perfectly good coach in the back room who would have been able to G up the players. And I think we've gone into a position where we've gone for a manager who is not in a strong position to another manager who is not in a strong position in the hope that it will be enough of a fresh start. I just think it's probably not going to be worth it. I think we're going down one way or the other. I don't think it really matters what we're doing. I think our running is too difficult, and the other clubs around us have got better games than us, and they've got more momentum. So I think we're going down anyway. I think the board needed to realise that and kind of go, right, let's just save a bit of money, because we don't want to go and do what Villa did the year that they went down, what Fulham did when they went down. We want to actually, if we're going to go down, let's stabilise and do it quickly.
I think if you look historically at the clubs who have attempted to put someone from the back room into the manager's hot seat when they're in a relegation scrap, I think they've all gone down. I can't think of one off the top of my head who has kept them up.
Gary Monk's the only one I can think of.
Really? Who's that?
Gary Monk at Swan did all right when he replaced Lowry.
He had quite a lot of time to keep them up, but didn't he?
Oh, true, yeah. It's not like a... Yeah.
Relatively, I'm trying to think of towards the, you know, like... Although Chris Ramsey had a lot of time to keep Wolves, I think it was Wolves, up and didn't. So, but generally they take them down. Maybe by bringing someone in from outside, they think, well, we've still got half a chance of staying up. But you know, you're talking about the running being too difficult. In which case, yeah, you're right. Maybe it doesn't matter if your running is that hard. But then if it doesn't matter, why not just keep the man in place?
Well, I mean, that was the other option. I think the fans' patience had completely and utterly left for Pellegrino. I think he was pretty much hated at the club, kind of damned as the man who took a fairly promising squad and turned them into relegation candidates. In that position, you kind of want to have a bit of positivity going into the final part of the season, you know, where we're going down. We're going to be in the Championship next season. We're not going to be pissed off at Kelvin Day. He's a club legend. We're not going to hate that at the end of the season. That will then go on to the board, which is again why I think they've avoided making that decision, because they know that it won't be that we hate the manager. It will be that we turn on the board. I think they've gone for the option that means we can still blame the manager at the end of it.
But kind of like Alan Shearer's appointment at Newcastle.
Yeah, exactly. They realised that was a turning moment for it all hates the board because they can't really blame Shearer.
Okay, so moving on from Southampton, there's a couple of other stories that have caught my eye this week in the news. Firstly, according to the Mirror, Luke Shaw's a target for Barcelona. They see him as a good investment, as a young player. Could you see that being a move? Could you see him? I think under another club he could really thrive, and, you know, if that is true.
Southampton get any money out of that?
We might get a little bit. I personally don't see it. Luke Shaw has got the potential to be a great player. The injury has clearly had a massive effect. And his mentality is entirely wrong. We've talked about that plenty. We know he's not got quite the right mentality of a top footballer. He's got the potential. The thing is, I just don't see it happening. And the simple reason for that is, even with Mourinho in charge, Man United are going to ask for a pretty big transfer. Because you think he signed in the first place, what was it, something like 35 million all in all for Man United? They're not going to want to make that much of a loss on that. And you think the amount of money that they'd have to pay Barcelona to get in Luke Shaw, I feel like they can get better value for money, and I feel like Barcelona, when it comes to transfers, are generally smart enough to not do that. So I think they can get someone else.
It's funny because I can see it at the moment. If he was to go this summer to someone like Barcelona, I could see the fee being something like in the region where we're all going to look at it and go, really? They paid that much for Luke Shaw? But if he stayed another season at United and did as little as he's currently doing, I could see him moving for about £8 million to Stoke or something like that. Mm. I genuinely could. So it's a bit of a strange situation where, yeah, someone who's a Champions League contender or established club coming in for him now would probably have to pay through the nose. But in a season's time when people will possibly have given up on him, he could go for very little, and then his career might kick on.
I think the thing is you've got to look at Barcelona's scouting. They are good at scouting, and they don't tend... If you were looking at the kind of players Barcelona sign, you'd describe them as winners, or players who had the potential winners. They've got that mentality. It's kind of all based on, look at Carlos Puyol and say, we want players like that. We want players with his mentality. Let's get the ones who want to win no matter what. They're 4-0 up, they want to get another goal, they want to keep the clean sheet. That's not Luke Shaw. That is not Luke Shaw in any way. He is a player who, the game's at the 80th minute, you're 2-0 up, he's thinking, what am I going to have for dinner? Genuinely, his mind is not on the game at that point. It's gone. He's in the training rooms. He's looking to get out as early as possible. He's not looking to stay around for another hour afterwards and keep training. He hasn't got the focus. He hasn't got the drive to go and push forward. That's what was limiting him at Southampton. It's what's limited him at Man United, I think, in probably the most significant way. Alongside the injury, yes, but I think He's always had a bit of a Jack Wilshere mentality. I've already made it. I don't need to try much harder. Those aren't players Barcelona signed. Can you remember the last player Barcelona signed where they had that kind of mentality? I can't. So that's why I don't think this story will ever happen.
I think in terms of mentality, perhaps you're right, but I do think Barcelona have made some poor signings recently. They signed Lucas Digne, who's a left-back. He's done nothing. Thomas Vermaelen, who had problems at Arsenal, and Andre Gomez, the midfielder, who's they've all done nothing. I personally think 25 million to a big team. If it were me, I'd take the punt on Luke Shaw for, say, 25 million this summer.
Well, that's the thing as well. All those players were pretty much signed to be squad players. Luke Shaw, the amount of money they'd have to pay for him, you wouldn't be paying that for a squad player. You could get a squad player for left. What's that Argentinian left-back, Tagliafico? You could get him for less money. He's a good player.
We'll move on from Luke Shaw. Just another quick story I want to mention. Panini stickers. I don't know if any of you still collect them, but they've gone up for this summer's World Cup to 80p a pack.
Is this what it's going to cost? Approximately £650 to complete a pack, your sticker album this year?
Yeah.
According to the BBC.
Yeah, so £773.60, according to the professor on the BBC. It cost £109, theoretically, if you got every sticker perfect. But yeah, £773, or if you do trades with Frenzy estimates, £330. Do either of you collect football stickers, do Paninis?
No.
I did for the 2014 World Cup. It was the last one. I thought I'll have a go just for fun, and I quite quickly got bored, so I stopped.
Kind of a form of child gambling, isn't it? when you really start to think about it, it's about as close to gambling as children can get. And as much as people go, oh, you know, back in the day when you're buying these stickers and filling out the albums, I think there used to be a slightly more innocent way to it, where it obviously didn't cost half as much money as it does now. But because of the sheer amount of money involved, it's now getting close to what I think is actually pretty unethical the more you think about it. It's no longer got that nice little, you know, innocent thing about it. It's kind of a bit grim.
It's possible to buy exactly the stickers you need on eBay and pay about 50p each. Because I did look at that when I was collecting in 2014. I've got to this stage. I wonder what if I could get them all. Oh yeah, I can. I can pick the exact ones that I need off on eBay.
Well, Panini
and save quite a bit of money.
Panini have defended themselves, saying the professor's study of £770 is a load of nonsense because people aren't living in a bubble, and they also argue that you can go through their website and trade your stickers for other stickers. You can do swaps with the website.
And there's always a bit on the last page that says you can send off for the stickers you need.
Yeah.
Isn't that to be the point? Isn't that the whole point of the whole stickers thing? Is you and your friends, you're doing swaps. You've got 20. Who was that player ages and ages ago? There was a Swedish goalkeeper, Aston Villa, and he was absolutely
Sorensen.
And that's true. It might have been him. I don't know. He was some Stefan something. I can't remember. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I traded about 20 of him. But I think in the day it was James Beattie. Because I really wanted James Beattie. And that was, for me, what all the fun about it was.
Yeah.
To get those one card you really want. If you can just go off and buy them, what's the point? That's almost like when you're getting into EA levels of pay to win. It's just like, what was the point of me doing it? This is what I'm saying. I think it's kind of lost its innocent, harmless, it's a couple of quid here or there thing to it. It's now just, it's a little bit too cynical.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Ultimate Team on FIFA can be very stressful, but I'm sure we could talk about that for an hour, and I don't want the show to be about Ultimate Team and the evils of that. all right, we'll move on from that. I want to talk a bit about England, as they've just played two friendlies. They beat Holland 1-0, drew with Italy 1-1, perhaps a bit unlucky with the VAR. Overall, decent performances, do you think? Were you pleased?
Do you know what? I'm normally a bit of a downer on England. We didn't play badly in either game. Yes, we didn't deal terribly well with the pressing of the Dutch team, and it was a bit of a sneak through it kind of game. The Italians, I thought, were unlucky. We showed some quite bad mistakes defensively, particularly John Stones. But overall, our performance was actually quite impressive with how limited the team was. And the fact that we played, you know, against the Italians, we played without a recognised central midfielder. Mm. Eric Dier is a centre-back, really. Chamberlain's a wide player, Lingard's an attacking mid, and we managed to dominate. So I think we kind of realised that our squad depth is actually quite a lot better than we thought it was. we've got a lot of options, and we have got a couple of in-form players. Vardy's in form, Lingard's in the form of his life. Oxlade-Chamberlain has actually really improved from the start of the season. He's starting to turn into an in-form player.
He's not a wide player anymore, is he? He doesn't get played wide at Liverpool, so he is fitting into that midfield role, and it's made it. He wanted to leave Arsenal because he didn't want to play wide anymore. He's not playing wide at Liverpool. He's not playing wide for England, and he looks like a different player.
And it's in central midfield where we have so few good players. I think, yes, I was a little bit disappointed when I saw the team selection that some players got missed out, but you know how it always is with us. Younger players you think are promising, and especially in the friendlies when you think there's an opportunity to do that. But ultimately, I think we saw an England side when the pressure's kind of off, when it's not about big names, we saw them perform, and we saw them perform quite well. If we did that in a tournament, beat the Dutch, draw the Italians, we'd be pretty damn pleased with that. Even if that was in a group stage, we'd be pretty damn pleased with that. So I think it's all okay, actually, really. I can't complain at all.
Shane can't complain about England. There's the title of the podcast. Peter, what did you think?
I thought the performance against the Dutch was better than the performance against Italy. You talked about their pressing. That was for about a 10-15 minute spell just after we scored. Other than that, I thought we pretty well controlled that game quite nice. It felt like a very rare thing of a somewhat technically and tactically sophisticated and modern performance from an England team. And I don't know the last time that we were genuinely able to say that. We've had good results and performances in Germany, but they've been a bit more, I don't want to say up and at them style performances, but they've been a bit more gung-ho. This had an element of control to it, mm-hmm. which was really good to see. I thought the performance against Italy wasn't as good. I think we rode our luck a bit, because the Italians did have good opportunities, did get into good positions. Immobile rather gave a Cavani-like performance. It's a great movement off the ball that we see from Cavani in Champions League games where he doesn't necessarily score, whereas over in Ligue 1 his conversion rate is much better. Immobile was quite similar to that. Brilliant movement, got into positions, but luckily for England, didn't take advantage of that.
Completely wasteful is the term you're looking for. Absolutely rubbish.
Just
that finishing.
But you've got to do something right before you do something wrong. He got the movement right. Unfortunately for him, he didn't get his finishing right. He is the top scorer over in Serie A, so his finishing can't be terrible every day. But on this day, it was.
Do you think Gareth Southgate's been clever with his team, because he recognises the deficiency in central midfield, and he seems to be setting up a proper system? I think moving Kyle Walker to centre-back as well, I think, is a good decision. Do you think Gareth Southgate's done a good job in setting up the side?
I think when you look at Southgate, we knew it from him in his earlier managerial career. We knew he was never a manager to get all of his players really G'd up, really fired up, you know, an inspiring kind of manager where all of the players want to play for him. It's not the kind of manager he is, not the kind of manager he ever was. It's not the kind of player he was. He's a smart tactician. He knows the game. He knows how it's played on the pitch and in practice. So he approaches it in that way. Now, that's very good if you're going into games where you need that. There are other games where you don't need that. So it very much depends on what we're going for. I think in a tournament it could bode us quite well, mm-hmm. that kind of approach, because then we're actually approaching the teams we're playing the way we're playing rather than the occasion. I think that's maybe where England have fallen down in other tournaments, is we play too much for the occasion. But there are some teams where I look at in the World Cup, and I think this might not be the best approach. We're going up against Panama in their first World Cup. They're going to do anything. We have no idea what Panama are going to do. They could do literally anything that game. There we need to be, I think we need to almost match them on that. Because I think if you're too tactical about it, it becomes too easy to play against. If you're doing the opposite, if you're really riding high on that spirit. And Tunisia, they're a similar team to maybe what Southgate tries to set up. Really, really tactical, really well-drilled. So I don't know how it will fare us in this current World Cup. I'm hoping it will be positive, and I'm hoping it will at least give better performances than what we've seen in previous tournaments. But ultimately, I don't think it's a bad thing. People have maybe looked at him sometimes seeing we play a little bit boring under Southgate. I think we just approach the games a little bit smarter.
Peter, are there any individuals which stuck out for you in the friendlies? Anyone who particularly impressed them, maybe pushed a claim for maybe a starting spot or a place on the plane?
It was interesting to see that there seems to be a plan in place, and in some ways, it feels like the plan is more important than the individual players, which hasn't been the case for quite some time. And that's the accusation that has been thrown at England teams. Players get picked on reputation, whereas Southgate seems to be picking players to suit his system. So in the, across the two games, you look at the performances of Sterling, the way that Rashford was used. These aren't surprising names, but they gave that threat of pace, which is interesting, because if you were playing Harry Kane up there, we might not have that threat of pace that these players get. And against better sides, you definitely need that pace to be able to threaten them for when they lose the ball, because they're going to lose it eventually. It's just what we do with it. You look at Leicester. Leicester were set up for what they could do when they win the ball. And Carlo Ancelotti has said a number of times that the best way to win a tournament is to defend well and hit on the break. So you need those players who have that pace. And the one who has really stepped up, and this is no great revelation, but Jesse Lingard looks like he has nailed himself in there at the expense of Dele Alli. Dele Alli is not currently the guaranteed starter that we all thought he would be. And Oxlade-Chamberlain has been mentioned earlier. At the moment, it looks like he's probably going to push himself into a starting spot. That extra energy, the forward runs from midfield that he offers as well from a deeper position. So probably Oxlade-Chamberlain's performances and Lingard's performances have pushed them higher up on the queue. And the other one is Kyle Walker as a right-sided central defender. He did pretty well in the games.
Yeah, okay.
I got to say, of Lingard, I never thought I'd be saying this, but he's been class this season. He was pretty good last season as well, when the more you think about it. I kind of think this season is maybe his Harry Kane season, and I'm not saying he's going to be anywhere near the level of Harry Kane. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the first season we saw him before, oh yes, it's actually surprisingly good, but will he do it again? And now this season again, we're seeing, oh, he's actually being surprisingly good, and he's not really dropping off at any point. He's actually doing it quite consistently now. And I think that is maybe the difference between certain other players, is that they can't maintain it game after game after game. It's like, oh, we score, you know, 10, 15 goals a season, but it's in the really easy games we do. Or we're scoring the third goal when we're already 2-0 up. And you look at Lingard, he's doing it in big moments. Again, that's kind of similar to Kane. They're always consequential, and that's quite similar, and he's doing it consistently. And I think at the moment, it's a point where people are sort of going, oh, but he's not actually that good. The question is, though, how long does he have to keep doing this until we actually realise, no, maybe he is actually quite good. Maybe he's not getting lucky. Maybe these aren't lucky deflections, all of that lot. It's clever movement. It's awareness. It's reactions. I looked in that Italy game and saw his closing down for that first goal of ours. That was just being, that was being 2 seconds quicker than everyone else in that midfield. That was his reactions being that much quicker. And it's why he got there, closed it down, got the ball through. Great run by Sterling. He's also been very, very impressive this season, but that one's a bit more obvious. But I think Lingard is turning into a very good little player. And at the moment, I'd have him start in the England squad. Because if I'm looking for players who are going to make a difference in a game, get that big goal for us, how many other players can I rely on? He's probably one of the big three at the moment. The other ones being Kane and maybe, in a strange way, maybe the likes of Kyle Walker in defence, offering that going forward, or Sterling. I'd have him not just on the plane, but I'd have him in the starting lineup at the moment.
There's the slight elephant in the room. Hate that phrase, but I've just used it. Is if you look how many players in the England team and squad have really got that many international goals? The answer is not many, and that is a slight concern. There's players who can nick you a goal here and there, but they do need to start scoring more regularly for their country. And it's not that long to get that going. There's a few games before the World Cup, and then we're into it. It's not to say players can't come from almost nowhere and score at a tournament. We've seen that before, but we can't. To say we're relying on Harry Kane is probably a slight exaggeration, but it's not a million miles away. Because basically, if Kane doesn't score quick, get Jamie Vardy on, he might score us a goal for the top 10 nation.
Hey, the funny thing is, if you watch when Vardy starts, he almost always scores for England. Maybe we take Kane off the bench.
I just talked about pace. There it is. Jamie Vardy's pace. I mentioned Leicester. If you're going for the Ancelotti method of how to win a tournament, you play Vardy wide as a wide-ish striker. You play Sterling as a wide-ish striker on the other side. And that's it, more than enough to concern any defence.
I do remember Vardy and Kane playing as, because I thought it would work on paper as like a split striker sort of system. I'm sure Hodgson tried it after Vardy had that really good season, and it just didn't work at all. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it tried again, but I do remember it being tried by Hodgson, I think, and it didn't work at all.
Might need to watch some videos of Leicester 5 years ago.
All right, I just want to move on to that. We need a better name for this section, but we're moving on to our 11s, for want of a better word. So we've been pairing up different 11s as picked. So last time out, I thought that the rest of the British Isles could challenge England to an 11 aside, and Hero picked England. I took the rest of the British Isles. Hero won with 74% to 26, unfortunately for me. Anyway, he's picked, he wants to do Europe versus South America, looking ahead to the World Cup. So any players for that? Shane, I believe you've got a South America lineup.
Yes, I do. I've gone for an excellent team here. There's a few from left field. And of course, as you'd imagine, it's mostly dominated by Brazil and Argentina. A couple of different ones, though. In goal, I've gone for Ederson. I think that's pretty much self-explanatory. The only other keeper who could compare is Geronimo Rulli, but he's just not at the same level. Ederson's world-class. Left back, I've gone for Alexandro. I could have gone for Marcello, but I think Sandro's had the better season. That's what I'm doing this on. Right back, Dani Alves. It's weird how he's still kind of at the top of his game, despite the fact he's about 35 now. Mm-hmm. But there we go. Centre-backs, I've gone for Diego Godin and Nicolas Otamendi. Mm-hmm. Now, Otamendi, you might think the likes of Silva should be in there, but I think you actually watch how he's played this season, and even the last couple of seasons, he's been class, and players like Silva haven't been. In central midfield, I've gone for Fernandinho and Ava Banega. Now, for those who don't know Ava Banega too well, I'll put it this way. He's a bit of everything. He can pass the ball exceptionally well. He can press the game really well. Good at his defensive work. He can properly cover the defence. He's a bit of everything. And I look at the likes of, what's his name, Casemiro and, Fabinho, he's another one. I think they don't kind of offer the same attacking threat he does. So mm-hmm. I've gone for Banega in there. Up front, it's a pretty obvious, actually. On the wing, I've gone for Messi and Neymar. Don't need to even explain that. Attacking mid, I've gone for Dybala. Could have gone for the likes of Coutinho, but I thought, James Rodriguez, but Dybala is class. I don't think you can argue that. And up front, I've gone for Suarez, and I had so many options for up front. The other options being Higuain, Aguero, and Cavani. I was quite tempted to go for Aguero, but then I thought that would just me be being Premier League. So I went for Suarez.
Fair enough. So I've got Hero's European team here. He's gone for a 4-4-2 diamond. He's gone for De Gea in goal. Back four of Carvajal, Ramos, Chiellini and Jordi Alba. It's a diamond midfield with Kante, the defensive midfield, Modric and Kroos in the middle, and Ronaldo as the attacking midfielder. He's gone for Kane and Lewandowski up front. I'd have picked a few different players myself, but it's Hero's team, so he's gone with that. So we'll put this up on Twitter, and you can vote either way, which side you think would win, Hero's European or Shane's South American 11. I think a lot of United fans will know how good Ever Banega is as well, to be fair.
I'll tell you what, that game between those two sides would be a bloody goal for me.
It would.
I mean, the sheer attacking power of the South American versus the sheer defensive weakness of the South American.
Which side do you think stronger, Peter?
I fiddled with a few teams, and I made a couple of little. Interestingly, went for an Atletico Madrid centre back. I went Jimenez ahead of Godin, but it's like virtually the same in many ways. I actually picked Firmino because of the season he's had, but that's slight difference. My European 11, I went for something slightly tactically more complex. I went with a back three. A diamond midfield and three up front, somewhat Cruyff-like. But Ramos, Chiellini, Boateng, Busquets, De Bruyne, Modric, Isco, Ronaldo, Lewandowski and Muller.
You know what? I think your 11's better than Hero's, and I've decided that yours is going in instead.
That's another diamond midfield. I've just gone for no wingers.
You don't need wingers in that team. I do think... I do think De Bruyne, who you mentioned, has got to be in the team personally.
Hazard was close. Iniesta was close in almost two positions. He could have played in Modric's position or behind the forwards. But the depth European 11, it's just so difficult to choose players.
Mm-hmm.
South America, it was basically a long list of Brazilians and then add a few players from here or there. Who wins? Who knows? A bit heck of it.
Yeah, well, we'll ask Twitter, see what they say, and yeah. We'll announce the winner next week. Just want to move on from there and talk about some of the other big nations and what they did in their friendlies. Probably the big story was Brazil beating Germany 1-0. Brazil came out, played their best team. They made only one sub in the game, whereas Germany made a load of subs and generally weren't really putting their best efforts in, I'd say. But for Brazil mentally, after what happened at the World Cup, that's a huge win for them, I think.
Yeah, they were definitely taking that fixture seriously, weren't they? There was certainly some catharsis being sought there. Germany weren't particularly impressive in either of the two games, I felt. A lot of people were raving about the Germany-Spain game. The first half was very good, but Spain were definitely the better side. And the second half was very bitty. It was one of those where the substitutions killed the rhythm of the game. And then in the game against Brazil, they were experimental. It was one of those classic German, right, we've got loads of depth, we'll throw these players in, let's see how they do in a big game. They used a friendly in the way that a friendly should be used. Let's see how our players cope against a really good side. The performances in the two games, not so amazing, but I don't think they are particularly worried about that. They know what they've got. They know the quality they've got. They're going to be contenders at the World Cup. I find it very hard to imagine a situation where they don't get out of their group.
Yeah, I think for Germany as well, it's an amazing record, really. It's their first loss since Euro 2016. And yeah, obviously both teams you'd expect to be contenders, both, you know, semi-finalists sort of area at least.
If there's a part of it that goes, I'd rather have that loss now than in the tournament.
Of course. France as well. France have caught the eye. They've got a lot of options in attack. They beat Russia 3-1. Mbappe scoring a couple. Paul Pogba scored a nice free kick as well for them. But generally, you look at all the options they've got in attack. They've got Griezmann. They've got Martial. They've got Lacazette. They've got Mbappe. They've got so many different options. It's an embarrassment of riches, really.
France are just scary. They're just frightening. And the game against England, where England got a VAR penalty? It was the first game VAR was used. First England game where VAR was used. And Varane was sent off.
Mm.
And they still won the game. And it was like they had an extra player when they attacked because of the type of attacking players they have. They've got players who will beat you one-on-one for fun. Mm. And sometimes they'll even beat you 2v1 or 1v2 as an attacker. They are so full of flair and game changers. They are, I'd say they're currently more Brazilian than Brazil.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I can see what you're saying. And yeah, I remember the game against England and I would fear for England, you know, fear for us playing against that French team with the amount of power they've got in their attack. And yeah, France definitely will be up there, you think. Also, another big story was the Spain v Argentina game. Spain winning that 6-1. A hat-trick from Isco. I saw he had a bit of a swipe at Zidane as well. He said something about feeling more confident and happy with the confidence of his manager that he doesn't really feel playing for Madrid. But yeah, a big, big result for Spain. And, you know, I guess from Argentina's point of view, move on as quick as possible from that, learn lessons.
If you were to look at the two sets of available players, not the squads, but the available players for Spain and Argentina, Argentina have the more glowing, shining name and individuals, but that has been their problem for a while, getting those individuals to play together.
Mm-hmm.
Spain, on the other hand, the list of players, they've got some very big names, some very famous players, some very good players, but you probably, if you look at the two squads, you've got, oh, Argentina, there's a few Ballon d'Or candidates there, and then Spain, not so much, not really. They're players who you put in your, probably your top 10 in the world if you were to do such a thing. But they are more of a cohesive unit. They play as a slick footballing machine, if you like. They are a team. They're an international team. And similar to Germany, they're going to be dangerous.
Well, yeah, like you say, you look at the attack and that's the problem, isn't it? You know, trying to fit in the Messi, Aguero, Higuain, Dybala, you know, and Di Maria as well, who's a big player.
You start with Aguero. It's all about an embarrassment of riches for France. Argentina have that in attack, but they can't get it together. Well, France to have found a way to play, if not all of them, but a good number of them together and keep a balance. There's no balance for Argentina at the moment.
I think that's the difference, because you look at Argentina defensively, they've got Rojo and Otamendi, who are reasonable defenders. They've got they play Tagliafico and Bustos, who are sort of not very highly rated. They've got Mascherano still in the squad, who, in my opinion, is a bit past it. And he's a key player for them defensively. They just haven't got that. Whereas, you know, you look at France, they've got players like Umtiti, like Varane and others. They've got Lloris in goal. They've got decent players at the back. And they've obviously got Kante and Matuidi in defensive midfielders as well. I think that's the key difference.
Yeah, arguably Argentina are a bit... It's a horrible phrase. It's one we usually associate with Arsenal. But lightweight. Are they lightweight defenders? Are they lightweight holding midfielders? Whereas France, they are a physically dominating side in those defensive positions. Mm-hmm. And yes, Spain aren't physically dominant, but actually the two centre, Ramos, Pique, they're not small players. They're not weak. Like, we know that they're... Ramos, although quite a clean player for his country, we know what happens at club level. He doesn't take prisoners. There's a toughness in there. If Ramos was Italian, we probably wouldn't blink. He had that sort of type of ruthlessness to his defensive play that you normally associate with Italian defenders.
And just finally, I just want to mention Belgium. A lot of talk around them. Possibly on paper, the best team. Possibly the best team going to the World Cup, if you look at 11s. Can Roberto Martinez do it, do you think?
Well, he won an FA Cup with Wigan. Anything's possible. they have, as you say, bundles of talent. They were terrible at the last tournament because they weren't deployed in the correct manner. I think he's changed the setup. Rather than using centre-backs as full-backs, seems to be playing a back three now, which he, again, go back to Wigan, he liked a back three there. If they can get the balance right, they certainly got the players. Who knows? Again, but you start talking like this, there's a lot of teams who have got the players. The talent is not lacking, and nor should it be. It's a World Cup after all. It's just whether they can get it right, whether they can knit it all together.
Bit of a strange one as well. They only played one friendly, whereas almost every other team played the two, and their friendly was against Saudi Arabia, which they won 4-0. It's not the sort of game that's going to tell you much. It's a bit bit disappointing, really, that Belgium. It's a strange decision, I think, not to play. You know, not to try and organise friendlies against a couple of big sides.
It could be that they're looking for something not quite so difficult, just so they can work on. It's not that long ago that they were playing a back four. So it could be that they are looking for something where they were able to have that opportunity to work on the formation and the system and people in certain positions without worrying about winning the game, worrying about, you know, it being a really competitive game. Because as much as these competitive games are great, there does become a danger that if you mess around with your tactics too much, you get embarrassed. We've seen that before. Didn't Italy get embarrassed by Spain? Not that long ago, Germany turned. We saw Argentina get embarrassed the other day. So that's not good for them. It's just a friendly, but they've been destroyed.
But do you not think, had they played, say they play a back three and, I don't know, play, say, Spain, lose 6-0, you know, they get a proper test of their back three, because Saudi Arabia aren't going to test their back three or whatever system they decide to play. Do you not think they'd be better? You know, even if they did get embarrassed and say, right, this back three system, we don't think it's going to work, let's move on from it. Or even just say, this back three system's not worked today. You know, we've been embarrassed because of this, this and this, and work on certain...
Possibly. What are their friendlies before the World Cup?
Are they more difficult? I don't know. I haven't seen that list. Or if I have seen it, I've forgotten it. It could be that they wanted a live rehearsal, but it wasn't that high pressured.
They've got friendlies against Egypt, Portugal before, and Costa Rica before the World Cup.
They've got one tough one there.
Mm.
Maybe it could be that they're thinking more about their confidence. I don't know. It's hard. It is difficult to think what the benefits are. And I'm scrabbling around trying to find some. But England have gone the other way. They've gone, let's play some tough opposition and test ourselves. Because, you know, England's problem has been that they haven't played tough enough opposition in the qualifiers. So they don't know really, oh, we've got this great record, but we've not been tested. So they've gone the other way. That's obviously their choice. Who knows if right or wrong, we'll find out at the tournament. But then when it comes to the tournaments and what happens in them, who really remembers what happened in the friendlies beforehand?
True.
Who they played.
True.
It comes down to what's the during the tournament. And mm-hmm. if they play well, they play well. They've got everything right. If they don't, probably Martinez's time over.
Mm. You're definitely right, though, with England. With you say, you know, we get lucky draws, you know, with easy teams, and we have for the last few qualifyings, as far back as I can remember. Anyway, I can't remember any, you know, obviously probably last time we didn't qualify and for the Euros. But since then, we've always had easy groups. But I do think, you know, in terms of organising friendlies, we've played Holland and Italy in the most recent ones. We've played France recently. We've played Germany recently, and we have. You know, generally had quite good friendlies.
They used the phrase prestige friendlies, haven't they?
Mm.
Basically just harder games.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's people who credit the emergence of certain South American nations as being competitive with when the qualification, it's now an epic qualification with 20 odd games, but when it became like that and these other nations regularly played against the bigger teams, the Argentina, Brazil, etc., that contributed to helping the other teams become competitive because they saw what they had to play against. They felt it when they got well beaten. And now it's epic and it's incredibly competitive. Argentina only just got through this time.
Mm-hmm.
So but it doesn't seem to be working for San Marino, admittedly. But if you are playing against higher quality, you have to do what you can to compete, otherwise you just fall away. And there's your argument against what Belgium are doing and for what England are doing in the friendlies.
Thanks for listening tonight. You can follow us on Twitter at V2 Football. You can also follow Peter at Peter Prickett. Check out our other shows, including The Wrestling Show, which Chris Lappin hosts. We've also got a Formula One show coming out soon. It's good night from me, good night from Peter, and good night from a vanishing Shane.